Scott Berguin from KSOWLP in Cottage Grove, Oregon. I have Nathaniel N.T. on the line from the Sustainable Forestry Network based in Eugene. Hello, Nathaniel.
Hi, Scott. How you doing?
All right. Let's start out by, if you could share with us what is happening with Sustainable Forestry Network, particularly pertaining to an initiative that you are working on.
Well, Sustainable Forestry Network's been around for a number of years, and the goal of the organization is to stop clear cutting and chemical spraying in Oregon's forests. And you may or may not be aware, but the state legislation that dictates how forestry operations within Oregon are managed is the Oregon Forest Practices Act.
Mm-hmm.
And that applies to all state and private lands within Oregon, and it currently allows timber corporations to clear-cut 120-acre lots with no permit process and no environmental impact statement. And it also allows for the use of highly toxic herbicides and pesticides, many of which are known carcinogens, like the 2,4-D, which was, of course, what they used in Agent Orange during the Vietnam War.
Right.
And so what we're working to do, one is to educate the citizenry of Oregon about what the effects of these chemicals they're using are, and then also, and the effects of clear cutting in terms of depletion of soil nutrient value and massive erosion and these kinds of things, but also to promote the positive alternative of sustainable forestry, which is not only ecologically sound, but is a labor-intensive practice. And so that's the main focus of what we're working on right now, is getting on the ballot for this November to reform the Forest Practices Act and basically mandate that the state employ practices that are known to be sustainable. We define that as non-toxic forest management and selective harvesting.
Okay, so you're going to try to do this, at least part of the campaign is to put this into an initiative that you're gathering signatures for right now?
Right. We've actually just started the petition drive within the last couple of, about a month and a half now, and we've got a long way to go. It's definitely doable, but we're kind of behind where we'd like to be right now. We've just got our Portland office up and going, and we're starting the petition drive up there. Actually, Barbara Kelly, who is our chief petitioner in Portland, was a woman who was involved with the SOS group, or Save Our Ecosystem, many years back, and successfully sued the federal government to prohibit the use of some of these chemicals on federal lands. Unfortunately, even with the current federal administration that we're dealing with, the national forest protections are far stronger than Oregon's. In fact, we have the worst forestry practices in the whole nation.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
We're behind California and Washington, and this is where all the timber is coming from, so this is where all the cutting's happening, and this is where all the chemicals are being sprayed, or the majority, we should say.
So what are some of the specifics of the initiative? What are people going to be hopefully voting on if you get enough signatures?
Well, essentially, like I said, it would mandate that the state employ practices known to be sustainable, and we define that as non-toxic forest management and selective harvest practices. The initiative itself specifically designates how and what we mean by selective harvesting in terms of the basal area of the stumps and the placement of the trees. So, like right now, a timber corporation, like I said, they can do 120-acre lots clear cut with no permit process, but they are required, at least technically required, to leave two trees per acre.
Excuse me.
Yeah. That's not much to start with, and it really does nothing to hold the soil in place, and
Right. It's
kind of an insult to anyone who's educated on how forest ecosystems work that this would even, this is the bone that they throw to the environmentalists here, look, we're going to leave two trees for you. But in reality, if you go out hiking and, you know, you get beyond, well, sometimes they're so blatantly obvious that they do it right along the roadside, but often they try to hide it a little bit, and what you're going to see is that they're not even leaving two trees.
Mm-hmm.
They don't leave anything because the Department of Forestry does not even enforce the minimal regulation that we have in place.
And just to be clear, you're talking about private land, or both private and state lands?
Private and state land, and 85% of all the cutting that's happening right now is actually happening on private forest land.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is something that we've run into a problem in the past. In 1998, we were on the ballot. A very similar initiative targeting both the clear cuts and the chemical spraying. The problem we ran into is that here in Oregon, private property is a huge political debate,
mm-hmm.
Where you have a lot of folks who really think that the government should have no interference and no regulation over what people do or don't do on their own land. Unfortunately, they're not taking into account the water and that flows through their land and runs downstream and the air that comes through and these kinds of things. But two important things to know here is, one, that what we're dealing with is timber corporations, primarily
mm-hmm.
Weyerhaeuser, Boise, Cascade, Georgia-Pacific. And these are folks who, one, they don't live in Oregon. If you look at the board of directors of these various corporations, you're going to find they're mostly from either down south or on the East Coast, and they have their money invested in everything from petrochemical, nuclear power, to weapons defense. And so they're not foresters, they're not Oregonians, and we really don't see why they should be managing, you know, how we conduct forestry operations within Oregon. Now, as far as their right to private land, well, one thing to note is that they acquired the land through illegal trades back during Lincoln's time when they first built the railroads
mm-hmm.
out. Those were, the land was deeded to the railroad companies to build the railroad and populate the area with, you know, white pilgrims.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially everything that was not used to pay for the railroad was supposed to be sold off at public auction and was not. It was sold at private auction to the timber barons. So that was an illegal trade in the beginning. But now, and I'm sorry, I might be getting off a little bit, but basically the point I'm trying to make is that even though they hold this title of private property, it was acquired illegally, but also we want to make it real clear that we're not going after small woodland owners,
mm-hmm.
and that as far as private property goes, anyone who owns 160 acres or less can file for exemptions to the initiative that we're putting forth. So it's written in that they would not, all they would have to do is basically file a financial grievance. Say, look, this is going to affect me negatively financially, and then
mm-hmm.
they're off the hook.
That it sounds like that's a place where you can pretty much expect, if this gets on the ballot, for that large timber interest to try to distort and focus on, like, you're gonna steal away, you know, mom and dad's timber that they've been growing to do the college education for their seven kids, you know, that sort
right.
of thing.
And that's exactly why we've written the exemption clause into
mm-hmm.
the initiative, so that they can understand that it's not the small woodland owners that we're going after, because mm-hmm. the vast majority of the cutting is happening on these huge lots owned by the corporations. And also, well, two things is you've got agriculture, like you have a designated forest land for agricultural purposes, and then you have residential lands. And so a lot of folks who just own, you know, a few acres and they have their house out there, that doesn't even apply in the first place.
Back to something a bit more mundane.
Okay.
In terms of the initiative, how many signatures do you need, and is there a timeline or time frame that you have to get those in?
Okay, well, we need to collect just over 75,000, actually, that we have to turn in that are valid.
Mm-hmm.
And so that means we really have to get about 100,000 signatures, because there's always going to be a margin of error.
Right.
Certain amount are going to be invalid for one reason or another. But we have 5 months in which to complete that.
Okay.
And we're, like I said, we're just at the beginning. We have a few thousand right now. And we're just getting started. So.
Okay, so you're hoping to be on the November ballot?
Yeah,
okay.
November 2006. And we're definitely looking for support with that as well. We are a grassroots nonprofit organization, and we're not able to employ quite as many people to go out there and collect signatures, so we really rely heavily on our volunteer and membership support, folks who are willing to just take it in and of themselves to go out there and get these signatures, being that this is an issue that affects us all. And a lot of people tend to look at the way nonprofits and political organizations work as, well, if I pay my dues, then they'll go take care of the environment for me.
Right.
And I guess that's something I really want to address, is that it doesn't work that way. I've been involved in a number of nonprofits and activist groups, and I can tell you that we're all overworked and underpaid and not getting the support we need. And that, it's really unfortunate, and you know, there's a lot of reasons for that. I mean, people do have busy lives now, it seems like more than ever. But really, you know, nothing is going to change as far as the forest practices go and as far as environmental movement as a whole without widespread support from the community. I mean, it's really the people who are going to make the change, not a handful of representatives.
Well, that seems fairly obvious, and it seems it's not overstating the point to say that if it if this issue or any issue relies just on the hardworking volunteers or staff of these nonprofits to, you know, make major changes in an issue like this, then it's it ain't going to happen. I think because one, the first step is getting it on the ballot. That's difficult in and of itself. But then you have to build it even bigger, because you're going to get the onslaught of advertising coming from the people that are going to oppose this. And I think you're right. Somehow the grassroots has to get energized and see this as important and get out there.
And you know, that actually, one thing I want to mention that's happened just recently, you may or may not have heard of the Pitchfork Rebellion. This is something that just occurred about, what was it, the weekend before last. It was organized out near Triangle Lake by some local farmers who had just been sprayed. The forest land surrounding their properties were sprayed, and they were addressing actually both the issues that we're addressing, clear cutting and chemical spraying, because they're dealing with the landslides on the roads and
in
their own properties. And they're also dealing with the chemical poisoning. And what had happened is a family near one of these areas where they just sprayed got very sick, and the father suffered a cardiac arrest, and the doctors, you know, tried to say it was, you know, for other reasons. But then right after that, within a few weeks, his 13-year-old son also suffered a cardiac arrest. And that's not, a common thing to have happen. And the whole family has actually decided to move, or that was last I heard, and I don't believe they've changed their plans, but because they don't want to live in a toxic environment.
Really?
And that's what we're doing. We're creating a very toxic environment for all our rural citizens.
One of the things I noticed when I worked for the federal government, for the Forest Service, and I can say I wasn't in timber, but I was on a forest that had a lot of cutting even before I worked on it anyway,
right.
That it's just one of those odd things, there's jurisdictional things, and you mentioned it early on in this conversation that you'd have the science that was used at the time on the federal lands was different as soon as you cross the jurisdiction, even to a state land and then to private land. So it's like, for some reason, the science was affected by who owned the property, which on its face is ridiculous, but that's what happens every day out there, and I think that's what you're talking about. You've got the federal lands, which are at least as we speak, more restrictive on some things, and more sustainable, I guess, in a sense. And then you've got the state lands that are operated, as you said, the worst forest practices, at least of the three western states.
Yeah, they're virtually unprotected. The bottom line is they want to make money off of trees, mm-hmm. and that has nothing to do with, well, one, the health and integrity of the ecosystem and surrounding human community, not to mention all the other, you know, animal inhabitants mm-hmm. of these once complex forest ecosystems. But, you know, one of the things that just made me think of is another issue that I was working on or am working on, which is related to consumer demand for responsible timber practices.
Mm-hmm.
And I've gone through and talked to all the local retailers of the Douglas fir and redwoods, and basically just lumber.
Mm-hmm.
all around, and tried to see who's selling what and how it's being certified, because there is, to make things even more complicated, they have certification programs that say independently that we've tested the way this operation is run and we've designated it to be a sustainable practice. And that there was the Forest Stewardship Council are the main folks behind this push to like really get it labeled so that people purchasing the wood would have an understanding of whether they were contributing to the destruction of the forest ecosystem or not. But what's happened is that because there hasn't been enough publicity on that, for one, and also just because of timber interest in squelching that attempt, one is that if you talk to Jerry's or Home Depot or any of the lumber retailers around here, you're going to see that what they're going to try to sell you is second growth timber.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to say, "Oh, well, we don't cut any of the old growth anymore." And well, it's interesting because, or they're not selling it because it's not there. I mean, we have literally cut 96% of our native forest. That means all the timber being produced now is already second or third growth. I mean, it says nothing to say, I mean, I'm not saying that it's okay to, you know, cut old growth and,
right.
and market that, but really, it's not happening. It's such a small, small percentage of all the lumber out there that to market this stuff as second growth is kind of a joke. And then the next best step you're going to find is certified Sustainable Forestry Initiative certified lumber.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually basically a front for the timber industry because there's no legal definition of sustainability. They just say, well, this is sustainable, and we have this independent agency that's going to market that way.
So basically there's no sustainable standards as there are, say, organic standards.
Well, that's what the Forest Stewardship Council was working to create,
mm-hmm.
and they did create this, better than anything we have on the state legislation
mm-hmm.
guidelines for sustainability. Now, I have issues with it because they do allow the use of some herbicides,
mm-hmm.
and I personally don't believe that we should be using herbicides in forestry operation.
Right.
But it's the best thing available, and the attempts and what they're trying to do is, you know, deal with the problem that's been created, in that if you manage a forest environmentally consciously and sustainably, you can do it without the chemicals, and that's not a problem, except that once you've already introduced a lot of these non-natives, like the Himalayan blackberry,
mm.
then it becomes a lot more,
right.
more difficult to address that issue.
Right.
So it's not just you know, doing things from right for right now, and from here on, it's undoing all the damage we've done over the last several decades.
Okay. Well, we're running out of time here. I think what I'd like to have you do, if you don't mind, is just tell us the simplest way for people to get a hold of the petition to sign it, if there are any simple ways, and also the best way or ways that folks can get on board and you know, be part of the grassroots effort that it's going to take to bring this thing to the ballot and to victory on the ballot in November.
Well, our main office is in Eugene at the Growers Market, and that's down on the end of Willamette Street by the train station. We're in room number 211, and you can also check out more information on the campaign that we're working at on the web at www.sustainableforestry.net. And if anyone out there would like to talk with us and learn more about what we're doing and how they can get involved, our phone number is 541-684-4850.
Okay. Well, any other final points you'd like to make before we wrap it up?
Yeah, there's actually several. Basically, what I want to say here is that we are not talking about a theory of forest practice that some scientist at some university has devised, this idea that no one's, you know, shown to be viable. A big part of the problem that we're facing right now is a lot of folks in Oregon have the impression that clear cutting is the only way to do forestry.
Mm-hmm.
That sustainable forestry is not a commonly understood practice, and that's part of the whole education and outreach aspect of the campaign, is simply teaching folks that you can manage your land without chemicals and without clear cut.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that means it's a labor-intensive practice.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually have to employ more people.
Mm-hmm.
And then you increase forest diversity, and you can still make a profit. And that's basically what I'm trying to say here, is that there are a number of operations throughout the state that have been in operation for 20, 30 years, and they're continuing to succeed. And they've been doing this, you know, for several decades, employing more people, increasing forest diversity, making a profit doing it.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason it's not happening on a wide scale is that the timber corporations would stand to lose some money in the short run. And because they're a corporation, the way they operate is simply to make as much money as they can in as short a period of time as possible. They look on annual cycles.
Mm-hmm.
And like I stated already, they're not foresters. They're not looking at things in terms of how the forest ecosystem is going to regenerate and how healthily it can keep producing the product that they're marketing. They're basically looking at, like, well, how do we continue making a lot of money in a short period of time? And, well, we've got all this land, so we can clear cut all of this, and it'll take a while to get it all down. And then when that happens, we'll figure something else out.
Right. Right. Maximum yield, maximum profit for the shareholders.
Right.
Right.
At the expense of
right.
every single individual living organism in this state.
Right. Well, it seems like it should be enough just to tell people that, you know, basically all these forest lands is where our water comes from.
Right.
And,
you know, that's Douglas for, I mean, healthy forest ecosystems filter the water,
mm-hmm.
keep the water clean and pure, so not only destroying those ecosystems and taking all the trees off and then, you know, destroying the integrity of the soil, not only does it not effectively filter out our water, but they're adding toxic chemicals to
mm-hmm.
it.
Right.
Known carcinogens. It's going straight into our drinking water, and we're all being poisoned. And even, you know, a lot of people try to spin this as environmentalist versus, you know, loggers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the case at all. What we're talking about is giving more jobs to more people in a way that's going to make a healthy environment for all of us to live in and make money for everybody who's here. You know, keep the money local, keep mm-hmm. it in the local economy. And I'm sorry if Weyerhaeuser has to suffer a little bit because of that, but personally, I think they're doing okay. I think they can afford to cut back a little.
So really, I think often people would probably hear, when you're saying sustainable forestry, they think you're talking just about, you know, nice places for the birds and the animals to live and the water and so on. And really, it's sustainability. An important part of that, a critical part of that, is sustainable economically as well, which massive clear cutting has been proven to be not sustainable. In terms of economic terms.
I mean, in terms of, you know, just even if, say, you don't want a diverse ecosystem and you're not interested in providing jobs for the people in Oregon, even if all you want to do is make money off of a resource, well, clear cutting is still completely backward because each time you do it, you erode all the soil that's going to...
Right.
You know, hold the new generation of trees. And you can talk to any woodworker out there, any carpenter. They're going to tell you that the quality of wood today is just nothing compared to what it was even 20, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Because each generation is genetically inferior to the last.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just going to get worse until the soil just stops altogether.
Right.
Which, you know, a lot of folks will argue we're pretty close to.
Why don't you give that phone number one more time and the website, if
sure.
you don't mind?
It's sustainableforestry.net.
Okay.
And our office number here in Eugene is 684-4850. That's 541-684-4850.